is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Mike Schatzkin, who is the founder and, I guess, head of Ideolog, or the Ideological Company. Sorry, Mike, how are
you? That's right.
Because your blog is called Ideolog, is sometimes...
Well, no, actually, what I did was years ago, I got too cute by half. And in the early 90s, when I had the Ideological Company, I thought it would be really cool to have the blog called Ideolog.com.
Right.
Which, of course, just created stupid branding confusion that I've been living with ever since.
Right. So, I now think of you as Ideolog. But in fact, I will tell you, I think the Ideological Company, the name itself, is one of the great names ever invented.
Well, I enjoy the name, and I'm glad I have the name, but I will tell you and your audience for the first time that I'm seriously considering just ditching it and going under Mike Schatzkin, because all my friends are telling me, Mike, you know, you're the brand. The company's not the brand. You're just wasting your time with having the company. But when I created it in the first place, I was trying to be modest, and I was modest. I didn't think my name was worth that much. So I thought I would have a cute company name instead, but I seem to have outstripped it.
Well, what you've done, I think, is you've created the brand by your own action. And because you're a public figure and you talk so much about the book business, you literally have branded yourself.
Yeah, and of course I've compounded that, but Mike Schatzkin is very clear, and what the company is confused, by, as you've just pointed out, by the fact that I can't call my website the same thing I call my company.
Right.
Enough about my mistakes.
Well, but it's fun to talk about it anyway.
Yes.
So, I usually open these by asking the person I'm talking to for just a biography. In many cases, I'm talking to people who are not that well known in the book business, whereas you are. So maybe you could just give like the 5-cent Mike Schatzkin biography.
Well, I think the most important part of my biography is that my father was Len Schatzkin, who was really, although perhaps not as widely recognized as he should be, the leading publishing business innovator in the period from World War II till the end of the 60s. And he invented standard trim sizes for trade books, even though they were standard for mass market paperbacks, but he created the idea of standardizing trim sizes for trade books at Doubleday. He invented the large sales force. He had a 40-person sales force built at Doubleday when most publishers had about 7 people in the field. He did vendor-managed inventory at Doubleday in the 1950s, which almost nobody, Random House is doing it now, but no one else has really ever imitated that since. And I sort of learned the business from him. He knew production, he knew sales, he knew, and he wasn't really an editor, but he was a very literate man. So I started, and then my mom was a management consultant, and then working as a summer job for her once I planned a scheduling system for a printing plant when I was in college. So I was sort of born into the business. I worked at Brentano's bookstore in the brand new, just open paperback department in June of 1962 when I was 15 years old, because Brentano's reported to my dad and I could get that job. So I think that really my career is in many ways the result of following a path of least resistance. And I was just sort of born into an understanding of the business and an interest and reverence for the business, and not coincidentally and not irrelevantly, born into knowing a lot of people in the business, which obviously is always beneficial. So I sort of feel like I'm sort of standing on my parents' shoulders, and that's probably the most important aspect of it. But then since the late 70s, I worked with my family in a family business in the 70s. Since the late 70s, as I describe it, I've been gainfully unemployed, and I've worked with a very, very wide variety of companies, large and small, on a very wide variety of challenges since then.
So basically, I mean, you characterize yourself these days as a consultant officially.
Oh, yeah, I'm a consultant. I've been a consultant since 1979. I think that I have... Over the years, it was a very varied practice. Now it's really kind of focused on the questions of digital change.
Right. And in a kind of, you become a futurist in a lot of ways.
In the early 1990s, I was compelled to learn about this by working with a couple of other consultants Market Partners International and a company called McNamee Consulting. And we were looking for something we might do together. And I think it's about 92 or 93. And somebody said, well, you know, I'm hearing a lot about electronic publishing. Maybe we should learn more about electronic publishing. And we put on a couple of conferences in the early 90s, one's co-sponsored with PW, that were, I believe, the first publishing conferences for trade people about digital change. And then I had the good fortune to be engaged by Vista Computer Services when they wanted to look at this on a sort of a regular basis because they sold systems. And they were thinking, well, we sell systems to keep track of books in warehouses. What if there aren't any books and what if there aren't any warehouses? And our clients need to know about this too. So they undertook to study digital change, and I became part of the group that did that, which meant that I was being paid a nice annual consulting fee to read and learn and think about the future. And 5 or 6 years of that was a, gave me a terrific head start at being able to prognosticate or pontificate or guess about where things are going.
Well, of course, I mean, there is the practical reason. I think sometimes, you know, those of us who are interested in the future, and I think that includes a lot of people, but not everyone, I mean, we're interested in it for a reason. It's partially to be able to know what to do to prepare for it, to make business, you know, to make business work in that evolving future. So you're trying to come up with at least an educated guess of the broad stroke of what's going to happen so you can be prepared for it and actually run your business successfully.
Yeah, and I think I think you're, first of all, completely correct in what you said. And I think that the challenges are fantastic because we're going to go from a we're going to have a business 10 or 15, 20 years from now. It's not going to be recognizable compared to the business today. And it's an extremely difficult transition for any company to make or any person to make. And I think that the in some ways impossible. And you know, it's often said about the railroads that they were just dumb. If they had known they were in the transportation business and they could have become airlines.
Right, that's a famous line, I think.
Yeah, and I just don't think it's true. You know, I just don't think that there's anything about running a railroad that qualifies you to run an airline. And particularly, I don't think there's anything about running a railroad that runs that qualifies you to start an airline, which is what you would have had to do in 1910 or 1920 or 1930. And similarly, book publishing is going to be a completely different animal, and all the skill sets that publishers have developed from, you know, understanding what paper would work best for the book design that you have in mind to figuring out how to get a stack of books in the front of the store. I mean, all these skills are just not going to mean anything 10 years from now. And that's a very, very challenging situation for people who have spent years developing capabilities.
Right. And of course, the other thing that happens is innovators who have no background, you know, kind of no overhead, no embedded overhead of either business structure or expectational knowledge, look at the emerging world, whatever the change world may be, and come up with brilliant ideas that they can actually implement because they don't have the baggage from the past.
And that's 100% correct. And where that is playing out at the moment is in the ebook royalty space, where if you talk to the trade houses, the big trade houses, they'll explain to you why 25% is the right royalty, 25% of revenue. And I think that broadly speaking, you know, I have a couple of justifications. One is that for the most part, the author is getting more or less what the author was getting before if they pay that royalty. The second thing is that they are able to deal with their cost base. But, of course, their cost base is built around distributing printed books. Now, today, that's not a bad justification because you're still selling, depending on the book, 50, 60, 70, 80, or 90% of the books in print. And an author that wants to be thoroughly distributed needs to have a print component to distribution. So they shouldn't resent helping to pay for the overhead that makes that possible. But as that number of print books goes down, it's not going to make as much sense to the author to be paying for overheads that they don't really care about. And a small new company like Jane Friedman's Open Road Media which doesn't have a print overhead structure, finds it possible to pay 50% royalties on e-books and sees that as working just fine. So that goes to your point, you know, that the legacy overheads can be a millstone.
Right, and also that the, you know, we can expect the unexpected, that the things that we're looking at every day as, you know, the change in the way things work and trying to adapt to it, for some people are spurs to innovation that and invention that will change the world that we, even before we are able to be ready to cope with it.
That's right.
And, I mean, I think that's actually, you know, I see some, you know, obviously there's some generational issues to it. You had said something to me once recently that you had wished you were born either 10 years earlier.
Well, I'm glad I wasn't.
Or glad, no, glad you weren't.
I'm glad I'm not 10 years older or 10 years younger, yeah.
Well, I wonder, though, if, you know, it does seem that there is a generational perspective that changes the way one looks at technology, the way one looks at values and who does what. You know, if some of this is just comes from reading randomly on message boards, you know, when people talk about things like royalty rates or DRM or, you know, the what will happen to authors as e-book prices come down. Because, there, you know, as you've written, I think you've written about this and talked about it, we also are now faced with a massive influx of production.
That's right.
The bound, you know, the barriers. I remember, you know, in the this was all discussed a lot in the 70s and 80s as desktop publishing
yes.
and low cost printing changed the dynamic, and it made it possible for almost anyone to become a publisher, and that was bemoaned by some and celebrated by others. But now we have 25 or actually 30 years later a new revolution, and that is there are no barriers to publishing. For authors, for, you know, anybody who can really learn how to operate software and learn the mechanisms of distribution, it's really radically different now.
Well, you hardly have to learn anything, really.
Well,
I mean,
I talked to a writer the other day. You know, I'm sure you hear this kind of thing all the time, but a writer approached me who got her rights back on a book that had been published commercially, gone out of print, mm-hmm. and she wants to revise it. And her absolute intention is to publish it herself electronically
yep.
and print on demand. And, you know, I told her what I knew. I mean, it's not a you know, it's not like a job that I do for people. You know, it's too small,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be hired to do it.
Right.
You know, you can call companies that do these things, and, you know, for Amazon and for Barnes & Noble, they make it pretty easy.
Well, Amazon makes it easy. Barnes & Noble makes it easy. Smashwords makes it easy. I've got a client called Bookmasters that based in Ohio that sort of gives you all this with a kind of a little bit of personal hand-holding, too. And I think there'll just be more and more capabilities. But Smashwords, if you can follow directions online, I mean, if you can work from a cookbook and make a souffle, then you've got all the knowledge that you need to publish an ebook through Smashwords. You just have to follow instructions.
Right, and it's basically Microsoft Word properly formatted.
That's right.
And, of course, it does require learning some skills that may not be skills you need very often.
Right.
And that's an argument against authors doing this, but so many authors are going to do it. It's going to change the dynamic, as we've seen discussed recently in reference to the bestseller list for ebooks.
Yeah.
This whole discussion of Amanda Hocking, I mean, she and C.A. Conrath and a few others, although they're, you know, she's different because she was previously unknown and unpublished, whereas Conrath was known and was published. But clearly, it is possible for anyone who writes well or something that people want to read to now enter the marketplace on their own.
Yes, I think that the barrier now is marketing, not distribution. That's the change. And but the fact is, as the number of people that read ebooks rises, and all it does is rise, and all it will do for the rest of our lives is rise, and the number of people that you need to reach with print diminishes, and it will only diminish, then you know, you don't need investment. You don't need a warehouse. You don't need an operation that can run anything. You need to go to Smashwords or somebody like Smashwords and get in the game. And then all you got to do from that point on is figure out how to get attention for yourself. But then, as we know, there are a lot of authors that already get the attention for themselves. The publishers are actually looking for the authors that know how to get attention for themselves, and those authors might be asking more and more why they need to bother with a publisher.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I think you wrote a piece last month, Upstream and Downstream.
Yes.
There are two pressures, I think, happening at the same time. Not only, as you call them, the anonymous author, you know, that's the slush pile come to life, but also professional organizations, the New York Times, TED, any number of content providers can also see that they can enter book publishing without, I mean, they have plenty of skills. They have lots of content. And
they have the market.
And they have they have brand names, market, and marketing actively, in some cases, better than publishers do. So when I think about, you know, the publisher saying to the author or saying to the brand holder, if you have a platform, then come to me because I can take advantage of that for you. Now, I think that there's a danger there for publishers, not just because people may say, as you just suggested, well, what do I need a publisher for? But they may say, I need a publisher still because print publishing is still, there's a business there, and print publishers, as the legacy business, knows how to do that better than anybody else. But it means then that publishers become licensees rather than owners of content.
Well, I think, first of all, next blog post will make clear that I believe publishers are licensees and have always been licensees. They don't actually own anything. The preview on that post is that we don't actually buy ebooks; we license them, and that's a misunderstanding that leads to people getting all upset because they can't lend or resell the thing they quote-unquote bought, but they didn't actually buy it. The fact is it's a licensing business from day one. The author owns the copyright. The author owns all the rights. The author licenses some of those rights to a publisher to exploit further. So I think that part has always been true. But there's no question that the publishers in some ways are have to be worried that they're getting what they wished for, because they were wishing for authors that would know how to promote and market themselves. And they would just, you know, but they wouldn't be able to get a stack of books in the front of Barnes & Noble. Well, as long as that stack of books in the front of Barnes & Noble is important, then the publisher's important. But as that stack of books diminishes in importance and you're expecting more and more of your sales to take place as e-books, well, the publisher doesn't really get you a lot of advantages in e-book distribution relative to what you can do yourself. So
it's a real
problem for them.
Right, and I remember saying this a couple of years ago to publishers who were seeking distribution, that the differentiation in distributors used to be, you know, whether they were really good at sales or whether they were really good at taking, you know, helping publishers find new markets. As the markets have codified and shrunk, you know, distributors have more difficulty differentiating themselves. And I think to say now it sort of passes downstream. Publishers have more difficulty differentiating as what they do for an author now becomes less creative or less open to change because the retail markets have shrunk in the bricks and mortar side.
That's right.
Which I guess inevitably gets us on this 11th day of February when we're talking. And this interview will probably post maybe a week or 10 days from now, so an event that I'm about to ask you about may already have happened, and that is, you know, with Borders now recognizing, I think, the inevitability of filing for bankruptcy, how do you, you know, I'm not asking you to do a crystal ball on what's going to happen to Borders per se, but what do you think about the reduction in shelf space for print books, and how is that going to play out over the next couple of years?
You know, it's amazing how many people have been asking me that question over the last 10 days or 2 weeks, and I don't know whether that's because of Borders or because the word has gotten out that I'm willing to say some concrete things about what I think about this. My sense, and I think I first wrote this about 3 or 4 months ago, is that we'll see a 50% reduction of shelf space for books at brick and mortar over the next 5 years and a 90% reduction in shelf space over the next 10 years. And I just don't see any way around this. I think that it's a combination of the migration to ebooks and the migration to purchasing online, and it doesn't really matter which way brick and mortar loses the sale. As they lose the audience substantially, they got to reduce the shelf space because there's no other way that the business makes any sense. I was in Italy last week, and somebody talking about digital change and talking about the disappearance of bookstores and the impact of all these things, and somebody asked me whether I attributed Borders' problems to ebooks. And what I said was that when the flu hits town, the old and the sick die first. And the ebooks are the flu hitting town.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is Barnes & Noble will still make profits. Barnes & Noble still is pretty much unleveraged, and that's a pretty clean balance sheet. There are lots of anecdotes about individual independent stores that are doing well. I think that if Borders were to actually file, that probably everybody else gets a lift temporarily. I mean, Borders is still the second biggest retail account for almost all at brick and mortar for just about everybody. Not all the sales will be kept, but some of the sales will be lost. Some of the sales will migrate to online, but some of the sales will just move to independent and other chain stores. And so I think that the immediate result of Borders filing, if they file, and of course we don't know exactly what will happen. Will the number of stores reduce by 2/3, or you know exactly what will happen? But we are pretty sure that there will be a significant shrinkage of shelf space when that happens. That means that the shelves that remain will pick up some traffic from the shelves that were eliminated. And so I think that it's probably, in many ways, going to be a healthy thing for the remaining part of the brick-and-mortar infrastructure, but that the erosion will continue. And a year or two or three from now, we're going to need another big reduction in shelf space. Now, everybody's trying to do this. I mean, Barnes & Noble and Borders have been trying to reduce the shelf space for books very obviously for at least a year, if not more. But I think another concern is what happens if Walmart or Costco or one of those places, Target, decide that books aren't worth it anymore. And, I mean, that's another – they're competing with, you know, applesauce or ladies' underwear or whatever it is they might be selling instead of books for more margin, more traffic, more interest. And that those decisions are being reevaluated all the time.
Right.
So I think that what's happening with Borders will provide a temporary lift for everybody else, and I think it's something that we ought to get used to because we're going to be seeing it in ways large and small for years to come.
So what happens, and this is maybe, I'm not sure you can answer this question literally, but the dollars that Borders owes publishers in the aggregate, $800 million or whatever, obviously has a major impact on the financial health of publishers. But also, insofar as publishers are directly driven by the amount of books that they can sell, if retail shelf space declines and ebook sales do not increase proportionately and directly proportionately along the same curve at the same rate, the implication is publishers of print books are going to have to shrink also, which is not exactly an easy thing to do.
Well, I think publishers of print books are trying to shrink. I think they're trying to publish fewer titles. I think they're trying to reduce their overheads. Let's get a couple of things I'm sure we can agree on, but let's make them explicit. It's not about replacing the volume and sales. It's about replacing the margin. And in fact, you get more margin on an ebook sale than you do on a print book sale. There's no printing cost, there's no warehousing cost, there are no returns to handle. Once you built the infrastructure, you've got a lot less in the way of running cost. So publishers could see their top line reduce, but not necessarily see their margin for running their business reduce. And so that's one thing. Secondly, in terms of Borders, if Borders is probably, I don't know, let's guess, 10% of many publishers' business. You're not going to lose all of it. Some of that is going to re-divert to other places. You're probably going to lose, I don't know, 2%, 3%, 4%. That's not good, and companies don't want to see that happening on a repeated basis. But I don't think that that is, in and of itself, is going to drive too many of the big guys into any kind of serious deep water. Obviously, there are there's great variation. I mean, there are going to be some smaller publishers who maybe have been considering themselves very fortunate for the last 2 years because they've been selling Borders very successfully, and maybe they have, you know, more than 10% in Borders, and they're going to take a bigger hit, and maybe they can't afford it. And I mean, I'm sure that if Borders declares bankruptcy, that we will see troubled publishers over the next year or year and a half who are announcing their troubles and attributing them to the Borders problem. But I would be surprised if any of the big ones hadn't really, you know, sort of factored this in and dealt with it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Although, as you said, if this, you know, the shrinkage continues at the rate that you're suggesting, and, you know, you sort of compare it to, I was thinking when you were talking about Costco and Walmart, that, you know, a couple years ago, Best Buy discontinued most of its DVD business, replacing it with much more profitable computer stuff. And that was had a huge ripple effect on DVD companies. And again, like with Borders, it didn't put anybody directly in financial difficulty, but it certainly created a radical impact. And that's just one large company deciding that they didn't want to carry the kind of level of inventory that they'd been carrying before. If you multiply that out for books, it's going to be difficult, I think, for publishers to adapt quickly.
I think it's definitely going to be difficult for publishers to adapt quickly, and I think that there will definitely be people very, very largely affected by this. But, you know, in some ways, it's going to be another flu hitting town, and it's going to get the old and the sick first. So I had a conversation with, I don't think I want to name him, but a part of the owning group of a very, very large publisher. And we were talking about Borders about 3 or 4 years ago. And we were talking about the possibility that they go out of business. And this fellow said to me, well, Mike, you know, we're very diversified. We have a lot of sales in a lot of places. These guys are not just trade. And he said, but if Borders were to go out of business, I mean, we'd definitely feel it. And I said, well, temporarily. He said, what do you mean temporarily? I said, well, your competitors who aren't as strong as you are going to feel it worse. And you're going to, a year or two of Borders going out of business, you're going to pick up some of your competitors really cheap because they're hurt. He said, you know, you're probably right. So, in fact, the Borders demise, should it occur, when it occurs, will probably play to the advantage of some, even though it plays to the disadvantage of most. And strong companies will prosper for, you know, even in the face of this adversity.
Right, and of course, it does not affect scientific publishing, professional publishing,
exactly.
Academic
college publishing, exactly.
Right, which is a huge part of the book business.
Exactly.
Often, you know, we I think many of us are trade-centric. I know that we are sometimes forgetting that probably more than half of the book business has nothing to do with the book trade.
I think it's about half.
Yeah.
I think it's about 50-50. But, you know, the thing is that the trade business intrudes on all those other businesses. And I've done some speaking lately to school publishers, and one of the things that they love to have me talk about is the potential disruptions to their business based around the fact that the high school history teacher could publish his own ebook,
right,
and, you know, and make it 99 cents and have everybody in the class reading it and be competing with the expensive publications that are being created by big shot school publishers. So,
actually, I will say that in doing some work with my both of my two younger children, in the last few years, I have noticed that many, many school teachers post all of their classroom materials on their websites, which are widely available. So if you're looking to do research at that level. Again, this is high school and middle school science, math, social studies. There is a huge amount of information out there. They're not literally publishing it in the way that we think of publishing. They're not books for sale. It's just information that is quite valuable, given for free because they're making it. They're putting it up there for their students.
And as more and more of that material is there, there becomes another business, which is to curate and sort through that stuff and put it on a web, make it available through something like Flipboard, which I've just discovered, which is pretty amazing and takes all kinds of blog stuff and turns it into a magazine for you, basically. I can see the time coming when creative teachers are going to find all kinds of good curriculum material that's available for free that they will curate uniquely for their own classes. The world changes substantially when you get to the point that most of the kids have a device that can do this stuff. And we're nowhere near that point yet. I mean, it's still, you know, the devices are too expensive and they're too precious. But, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, all the kids are going to have screens that are like iPads. It's $500 for an iPad today. It's going to be $70 for an iPad 10 years from now, or the equivalent. And these things are, you know, everybody's going to have them, and it's going to be not much easier to get a formally published something than it is to get an informally published something.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you just, I guess, one kind of final question that is on a completely, you know, maybe in a different approach to things. I know you keep up with a lot of things that are going on. Almost nobody can keep track of everything.
I would say nobody can.
Right. But so of all the things that you've seen in the last couple of months or even couple of weeks that seem like really interesting, new, innovative possibilities, what's the thing that has really got you excited the most?
You know, that one's impossible for me. I have to say that at the moment, it's really the last couple of days, and it's been Flipboard, because I loaded the new Rupert Murdoch daily paper,
right.
The Daily.
Yep.
I've been reading the Daily News on the iPad, the New York Daily News on the iPad. And I think the New York Daily News on the iPad is better than the Daily on the iPad. They have certain devices that just work better. So I was looking at that, but then at the same time, I put Flipboard on, and it went into, I don't know, Facebook and LinkedIn or whatever, and everything that everybody posts turns into an article. It looks like a magazine. I mean, I think the possibilities there are fantastic. So that was sort of like, that's what struck me in the last week or two. But you're right. Your point about there's so many things you can't keep track of them all. There's so many things I can't even really like sort them all out. I really find myself having to focus on one thing at a time and sort of pull out the things to talk about. And in some ways, Smashwords is one of those things, right? And it's been around for 2 or 3 years now, but the ability of somebody to, with a very minimal amount of tech, and you're right, there's a small amount required, but I bet you could get a high school student to do it for you for $50 or $100. And the fact that anybody can get an ebook out that's now going to be up and available in all the major ebook outlets and just do it themselves, I mean, to think about what that means, I was reading an old blog post of mine and realizing that, you know, it's only been like 2 years ago when we would say that the ebooks were 1% of the business.
Right.
And now they're 11% of the business.
Right. Well, and I think there have been various times when you've talked about, and certainly other people have, the doubling effect is very powerful. You know, one goes to two, two to four, four to eight. It doesn't take very long before you're at 32.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, we are two doublings away from 50% at the moment.
Right.
Right. And we've been getting more than a doubling per year for the last several years. So, you know, I think that obviously that cannot continue for 5 more years because it would be more than 100%, right? But the fact is, in order to believe, I've said that ebooks will be 50% of the straight narrative text business before the end of 2014, That seems like an awfully conservative assessment now. And it's kind of hard to see why it would take that long, considering where we are at the moment. So, so anyway, I'm sorry I botched your last question, but it's been a great conversation.
Not at all. It was really fun to talk. We could do it again another time.
Happy to.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, David.
This has been Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Mike Schatzkin, whose company may now be called Mike Schatzkin.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.